You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this episode is presented by Rosalind English.
Hello, LawPod listeners. We're still quite newly arrived on the shores of the new year, but we already have in hand an important ruling from the Supreme Court. On the 11th of January, the court handed down judgment in the case of Paul and the Royal Wolverhampton NHS Trust, answering the following question. Can an individual make a claim for psychiatric injury caused by witnessing the death or other horrifying event of a close relative as a result of earlier clinical negligence? This case involved three conjoined appeals. Each appeal relates to a claim for psychiatric illness caused to the claimant by viewing a traumatic event which was caused by the respondent hospital's negligence. I have with me Judith Rogerson of One Crown Office Row, who's kindly agreed with me to discuss this decision. Judith has extensive experience of acting on behalf of patients, NHS resolution, and individual medical practitioners in a wide range of cases arising out of allegations of clinical negligence. Judith, very many thanks for coming on to LawPod UK to shed some light on this case.
That's a pleasure.
I think we should start with the established common law rule that's always been that in a civil court, the death of a human being cannot be complained of as an injury by another person. The same rule applies, of course, where the victim doesn't die but is severely injured. I quote from the beginning of the judgment that we're going to take you through today. Essentially, the common law does not recognise one person as having any legally compensable interest in the physical well-being of another. The law affords compensation to the victim, but not to others who suffer harm in consequence of the victim's injuries or death, however severely affected they may be. But Judith, of course, there are important exceptions to this basic rule of the common law, aren't there?
Absolutely. There are two main exceptions, really, and we'll focus on one of them today. The first exception is the Fatal Accidents Act, which is a statutory provision for dependents of a person who dies to recover the financial losses. We're not talking about that today. What we're focusing on for this podcast are claims by people who've suffered a psychiatric injury as a result of witnessing injury or death to a loved one. And that is an exception to that rule. And that's what the three cases considered by the Supreme Court in Poole were looking at.
So what we're talking about today is the secondary victim exception to the rule. And this involves what we used to call nervous shock and now is psychiatric illness caused by the experience of a secondary victim witnessing a death caused by negligence. But the critical question in this case depends on whether a doctor in providing medical services to a patient not only owes a duty to the patient to take care to protect the patient from harm, but also owes a duty to close members of the patient's family to take care to protect them against the risk of injury that they might suffer from the experience of witnessing the death or injury of their relative. This is a huge question in relation to medical accidents. Let's just go back to some of the big leading cases on nervous shock. And can I just ask you to help us through in the development of this particular tort? How important is the distinction between physical and psychological injury?
Physical and psychological injury suffered by the secondary victim, in principle, they could recover both. So if we started with the case of McLaughlin, which is the first sort of leading decision on this, and that was a claim that arose from a road accident where a woman came upon the aftermath of a road accident that involved family members. And in that case, it was the House of Lords looking at it, and they concluded that she could recover for both physical and psychiatric injury. But it's quite unusual for a person to suffer a physical reaction, physical symptoms as a result of witnessing something. If they've suffered a physical injury, they're more likely to be a primary victim. It's not going to be so controversial. If they've been in physical danger themselves, they're a primary victim. We're looking specifically at secondary victims. And in the context of clinical negligence claims, it's almost thinkable where you would have a family member who would have been in danger themselves. So they're almost always going to be secondary victims who will have suffered more likely a psychiatric injury than a physical injury. Going back through the case law, it's something that's been developing over a long time. It's been controversial. Those listening will be familiar with the decisions of Alcock, which followed McLaughlin. That was arising from the Hillsborough disaster. It was a claim by family members of those who'd been killed. And that built upon the decision in McLaughlin and set down what had been referred to as control mechanisms, which since that time have been relied upon by the courts. It really is the leading case on the issue. Again, those listening will most likely be familiar with those control mechanisms, close ties of love and affection with the victim, a psychiatric injury from witnessing the death or the extreme danger, physical proximity to the scene or the immediate aftermath, and then a close temporal connection between the injury to the primary victim, so their family member, and the perception of it by the secondary victim. And that final control mechanism is the one that really had been the focus in the decisions in Port up to the Supreme Court. And you've already mentioned that what they were looking at there as well was the duty of a doctor to third parties. That hadn't been the focus in the lower courts. The lower courts have been more interested in the issue of proximity in the time and space between the event that had happened and the death and the impact on the secondary victim. We'll come on to talk about that in a moment. But those were the control mechanisms in Alcock. They've been followed subsequently, but it's been recognised that the law was inadequate on this. Alcock was very much based on policy, understandably limiting the number of people who could bring a claim. There were special circumstances in Alcock because obviously the terrible events in Hillsborough had been witnessed by millions of people on the television. They clearly all couldn't bring a claim, and that was one of the reasons why the Court of Appeal came up with these tight control mechanisms. And indeed, in the subsequent case of White, also Frost, which was a claim brought by police officers who'd been at Hillsborough, their claim didn't succeed because they didn't meet the control mechanisms. The House of Lords there acknowledged that the law was defective, effectively, that there were inadequacies in this area of law and suggested it was for Parliament to sort out. That didn't happen. It's been the courts that have looked at these issues since.
So all of these cases, as the law on secondary victims evolved, it was very important that the triggering event should be defined in law. Even before we get onto the medical context, what is an event in this particular context and how does it qualify?
This is something that's been controversial and it's something that was looked at by the Supreme Court in Paul. Important case is Taylor and Novo, and that was the case that the lower courts in Paul concluded that they were bound by. Now, Taylor and Novo was an accident case where a woman was injured in an accident at work. It was, I think, some shelving collapsed and she was hit by some items. It was thought that she wasn't that badly injured and that she'd recovered, but several weeks later she died unexpectedly, and that was witnessed by her daughter. And the daughter brought a claim for psychiatric injury. That claim failed on the basis that there wasn't sufficient proximity. And you've asked, well, what was an event? Well, it's interesting because that was looked at in Paul by the Supreme Court in some detail. They reached the conclusion that the event has to be an accident. And in Taylor, they say the court was correct in their decision in Taylor because the daughter hadn't witnessed the accident. She witnessed consequence of it sometime later. That's not necessarily how Taylor's been interpreted, but that was what the Supreme Court has said it was finding. The relevant event was the accident. Up to that point, there's been controversy over what the event is. Is it the injury? Is it the first manifestation of the injury? That was something that was argued by counsel for the claimant in Paul. It's the first time that it becomes apparent that there's an injury, that that's the relevant event. Is it the collapse which leads to the death? Now, in the other two cases which we looked at in Paul, the person who died had had symptoms previously. So the first manifestation of injury wasn't the first time that they were aware something was wrong. This is why it's become so unclear. And when we get into clinical negligence, it becomes even more confusing. And again, in Paul, the Supreme Court, one of the reasons that they focused in on having an accident was that they said if you do otherwise and you look at the injury, it can be difficult to distinguish what is the event in itself. When does that start and end? And when does the aftermath start and end? Because in the clinical negligence cases, you're often looking at a series of events over time over several days or weeks. And in their view, in the Supreme Court's view, that isn't an event. But up until the decision in Paul, it was far from clear what the event could be. And there was a lot of controversy and debate in the cases over what the relevant event was.
I think this really is the crux of the problem, isn't it? That when you look at medical crises, I mean, sort of medical accidents, medical crises, whatever you like to call them, the difference between an hour a day, a week, and even a year matters, but then it's very difficult to partition in terms of the compensability of the secondary victim's shock.
And that's been the issue with the clinical negligence cases that were trying to follow the authority in Alcock. And again, the Supreme Court and Paul picked up on this and said the problem is that it was just assumed that the same criteria would apply as with an accident case where you've got a clear event that is an accident. The one case that when we've represented claimants, you will always rely on when you're the defendant, you're always trying to distinguish was Walters and North Glamorgan, because that was a claim for psychiatric injury in a clinical negligence context, which actually succeeded. It was a terribly sad case. They're all terribly sad cases, but this was one where a mother had found her baby very unwell, was taken to hospital, and then 36 hours later, the decision had to be taken to turn off life support. So the event there was a 36-hour period, which is a series of events, but the court said that was one event that qualified, and therefore the claim could succeed, that there was sufficient proximity between the negligence and the shocking event that followed. But in most of the subsequent decisions, the court said no, seeing someone in hospital deteriorating and subsequently dying in most of the cases, that wasn't an event because it wasn't a seamless course of events. So the various different phrases have been used. But in a scenario where someone was in hospital for days or weeks, the court said that didn't meet the test. And so that wasn't an event.
And of course, the medical context brings another problem to bear, which is defensive medical practice, which means that if you're a relative of somebody who is dying, possibly as a result of medical negligence, and you want to be next to them when they die, the hospital, if it's going to be liable for the suffering of the secondary victim, is going to adopt defensive practices and say, by the way, no, you can't be here. Well, I mean, I'm putting it in a very harsh light, but that would be the result, would it not?
Ultimately, but there's a second limb to the decision in Paul and why the claims weren't allowed. So that one of the reasons was they said the cases have been wrongly decided to date, or that the basis for the finding has been wrong, which is it has to be an accident rather than a series of events. It's not the injury that's relevant, it's the actual, it has to be an accident, an event that can be defined as an accident. And that doesn't apply in most clinical negligence contexts. The second part of their reasoning was more of a policy issue, and that was in relation to the scope of duty of a doctor. And they have said that a doctor effectively doesn't owe a duty to third parties. And it's interesting because there have been other cases on other aspects of the scope of duty of doctors over recent years. And in that, one of the reasons that they said that they'd reached that conclusion is because the doctor themselves can't control what happens afterwards. In Paul, it was the case where a father had collapsed and died from a heart attack in front of his daughters 14 months after a misdiagnosis. But so you suggested that it could lead to defensive medicine and family members being sent away so they don't witness what might be considered horrifying things. If we turn that around, one of the reasons the Court of Appeal said that there shouldn't be a duty imposed upon the doctors is because the doctors can't control what happens. And that was always one of the issues with the way that the law was developing. It did lead to, the court refers to it as happenstance, you know, one, things that were completely outside people's control. You could have had an anomalous situation where you walk out of an appointment where there's been a misdiagnosis. If you died immediately whilst you're leaving the hospital, potentially there would be a claim. But if you died 14 months later, the argument was the proximity means that your claim fails, or the lack of proximity. It leads to arbitrary outcomes that are outside anyone's control. That was always the problem with these decisions. But the Supreme Court now has said, firstly, it's got to be an accident, but more significantly, there is no duty upon a doctor. And going back to first principles, if you haven't got a duty, there's no claim, because you can't bring a claim unless there's a duty upon which it's based.
That does seem to be the hard-edged side of this particular decision. But just going back to our discussion about the event and the qualifying event and time, I think the Supreme Court says it very firmly when it says, "We find it hard to see why the defendant's legal liability should turn on the court's impression of whether or not the facts of the case fit the dramatic pattern of a Greek tragedy." And I mean, that does put it very eloquently, doesn't it? It's so difficult to determine whether something's qualifying or not.
And that line, paragraph 80, it jumped out at me as well. It was quite striking that they'd said other factors where they'd been critical of previous decisions, sort of similar reasoning by the Supreme Court, findings that there had to be a horrifying event or sudden shock. They were critical of that because they said there's not really, they said that there's not a Richter scale of horrifying events. So you had this horrible situation where you were having to determine whether something was sufficiently horrible to trigger events. All of these events, watching family members suffer in hospital, is horrifying for the person involved. And the Supreme Court recognises that in the opening line. It's a pretty punchy opening line to a judgment. The first line is, "We all die. And when we do, the fact or manner of our deaths may cause harm to other people." That goes without saying that that's true. It's horrifying to watch a loved one, whether you expect them to be unwell. It's a horrible event. But essentially what the Supreme Court have said is that, like, sadly, that is one of the vicissitudes of life, is that people suffer and die in hospital. And again, going to the scope of the duty of the doctor, they said, and towards the end of the judgment, to impose a responsibility on hospitals and doctors would go beyond what, in the current state of our society, is reasonably regarded as the nature and scope of their role. Although social attitudes and expectations may be changing, we would not accept that our society has yet reached a point where the experience of witnessing the death of a close family member from disease is something from which a person can reasonably expect to be shielded by the medical profession. They said it's a vicissitude of life which is part of the human condition. And that does sound harsh, but again, it's going back to the policy issue that started out with these cases of having to limit the number of claims that can be brought. But it's interesting to look at the dissenting judgment, because Lord Burrows disagreed with the majority because he said this is going to preclude loved ones from bringing claims in virtually all circumstances of clinical negligence, which is great in the secondary victim context. He thought that was unwarranted, and said that if this is an incremental step forward that would be allowing appeals, that that would be justified and principled. So it's looking at the policy issue from the other side. The majority said no, there are reasons not to allow these sorts of claims to go forward. But Lord Burrows thought that they should, because of their very nature.
I just wondered, taking the implications of this decision to a wider context, I mean, now we have a Supreme Court decision saying no secondary victim claims in following medical negligence, disasters, crises, or whatever you want to call them. Do you think that this very firm ruling by the Supreme Court within the medical context may affect decisions on secondary victims' compensability outside the medical context?
I think it could, because of what they've said about the need for proximity. And although the issue about whether it was the injury or the event, what the event was, probably mostly related to clinical negligence incidents, events, there may be other circumstances. I'm thinking of off the top of my head where it might apply. But I think there are other bits in that judgment which will have an impact. So, for example, the decision that you don't need a horrifying event, that's something that potentially has an impact elsewhere. They're effectively saying that Alcock has been misinterpreted in that respect, that it doesn't have to be shock. We've mentioned already these used to be referred to as nervous shock claims. But what the Supreme Court has said is that's really a sort of outdated approach to psychiatric injury and how they're caused. Things like PTSD, it's much more complicated than that, than simply saying it's a terrible shock that causes the injury. So in that context, it potentially, yes, does have an impact on other cases going forward. It's obviously had a huge, or it will have a huge impact on nervous shock and clinical negligence, which it does appear that claimants will struggle now to succeed. But it has tightened up and explained other questions that have been asked generally in relation to other areas where there could be claims.
This judgment, which is a long judgment, although pretty straightforward in its conclusions, seems to me a very good example of how the common law has evolved from one point through another. And we've looked at the questions of proximity, horrifying event, qualifying event, etc. I suspect that this is where we're at. It's not going to change. It's not going to become more victim friendly as policy questions and allocation of scarce resources, particularly in the NHS, is concerned. What do you see going forward after the Paul judgment? Are there cases in the pipeline that will now be dismissed?
I imagine that, sadly for claimants, that might happen. I certainly, from my experience, there were cases that were on hold. I think a lot of cases settled because both sides weren't sure what the outcome was going to be. The reality is with clinical negligence claims, a lot of them settled because there were always risks on both sides. But I think, yes, there's going to have to be some difficult advice given to claimants who've been holding on to these claims going forward. I don't think anyone knew what the judgment was going to be, but I was certainly a little bit surprised when I read it because the focus wasn't what I'd expected on the issue, on the duty of the doctor wasn't what I think most of us were expecting. We thought it would be a more detailed analysis of what proximity meant, because that had been the focus up to this point. But the scope of duty issue is something that has been looked at in other cases, Carmen Meadows, ABC and St George's. It is an interesting topic, just when and in what circumstances doctors owe duties and who to.
And scope of duty lies at the heart of medical negligence claims. So yes, that's probably where we should be finishing. Thank you very much, Judith. It's a long judgment, but very interesting to read. I recommend it to anybody who wants to learn about the history of secondary victim claims. And, well, that's where we are. And I think it's a pretty determined point.
Indeed.
This episode of LawPod UK was presented by Rosalind English. The series is produced by One Crown Office Row and Podcasts for Lawyers.